Thank you. Be seated.
Court will continue its argument session with Provident National Assurance Company versus A. Paul Stevens. Justice Baker is recused and will take no part in the deliberation or decision. The court is ready to hear argument from petition.
May it please the court, Mr. Chris Fredrickson, if you've been arguing for the petition, I'm going to give you 5 minutes.
Your Honors, it will please the court. Provident was the appellant, the plaintiff, and consistently and erroneously the loser in this process since 1985 when it loaned the first $5 million and then in 1986 when it loaned $6 million to Mr. Stevens and his partner then, Herbert Hunt, to buy what is substantially the Promenade Shopping Center in Dallas, Texas. Subsequent to that transaction, in 88 and 89, there were defaults. After uncontested, uncontroverted, appropriate posting, compliance with the property code, substitute trustee Ramsey on the 4th of July, 1989, under the scrutiny of a videotape on the courthouse steps in Dallas, foreclosed on the two tracts of property. He first read into the record, or read out the tracts, the deeds, description, and hearing no bid, stated that he was authorized on behalf of Provident to bid $8 million for the two tracts of property. Subsequently, Provident has sought diligently its deficiency judgment against guarantor Stevens. The issue for this court is, does a single combined bid by the trustee, subsequently recited in the substitute trustee's deed, prohibit Provident from securing a deficiency judgment against the guarantor Stevens as a matter of law? I want to emphasize to the court that there are no allegations of improper conduct in the foreclosure. There's no allegation, no pleading, no evidence that Stevens has been harmed as a result of the combined bid at the end of the videotape session. There's no allegation or evidence that says Providence allocation of the bid price between the two tracts of property has in any way been improperly impacted Mr. Stevens' liability. Stevens' position throughout the lower court and our two trips to the Court of Appeals has been that if there was a single bid, it would never, ever, ever, under any circumstance, be a deficiency. That, in fact, as a matter of waiver, regardless of what evidence and regardless of what reasonable allocation by Provident of the bid price amongst the two tracts of property, a deficiency could never lie because the bid price of $8 million was bid and cited in the substitute trustee bid.
Let me ask you that question from the other side of this. Is there any mathematical calculation that you can think of where you would allocate the bid in such a way that the deficiency would be less than the guaranteed amount?
If we had a hypothetical Rubik's Cube and played with this $8 million bid, under any set of circumstances, there would be a deficiency in excess of $1 million. Both.
In excess of how much?
Of $1 million.
How about
both it? Were limited. Both guarantees were limited. Both had caps on them. You could theoretically apply $6 million to one guarantee and $2 million to another. And come down with a lower allocation than what Provident did. Provident used simply an allocation related to fair market value of the property, which was, we believe, a fair and reasonable methodology.
But the total amount of the guarantee is more than $1 million, is that correct?
Yes.
Under any scenario, could you allocate the bid such that the deficiency would be less than the total amount guaranteed with the cap?
The first guarantee was limited in its force, provisions to a total of $1,256,000 without interest, without attorney's fees. The second loan on the second track was limited to a total sum of approximately $1.5 million, but it had interest added, plus it had attorney's fees recoverable. So they were different. Both guarantees were different. Both were limited. But under any scenario, if Mr. Stevens allocated the sums, there would be a deficiency in excess of $1 million, regardless of how it was allocated.
But he would be liable. If you allocate all funds to, say, the second note, there would be no deficiency on the second note, and so the only question would be, then he'd owe on the guarantee on note number one that didn't get paid off.
Which would be the 1 point.
If you allocated 100% to just one of those notes, he would get released of his guarantee on one of those notes. So there's a possibility.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's a possibility that you could improperly allocate that, but there's no allegation of that. There's no statement of that. It's just a hypothetical, as I heard this morning.
So the minimum number would be $1,256,000.
Minimum.
Now, Ms. Ferguson, let's take a hypothetical. Suppose that you'd had different guarantors rather than someone here who's one of the partners and one of the guarantors, but you had a third party who was a guarantor on just one of those notes. Is there any authority out there at all that says that the failure to allocate, if you make one bid on two pieces of property, that somehow cancels the deficiency on either property? When I'm talking about an individual guarantor only on one of those notes, who could come forward and say, now, wait a minute, you should have allocated against mine and not. Is there any authority out there at all that requires the bank to prior to the foreclosure bid separately or to allocate before foreclosure or anything?
Your Honor, I found no authority whatsoever that says the allocation and the process the Provident undertook in this case cannot be done. There's no prohibition that I've found that excuses even a hypothetical third person, as opposed to one of the partners who was in an unconditional guarantee situation. Realistically, what would normally be the practice in the 80s and in the foreclosure process is you would have the bid and you would allocate that bid. You'd bid it on the two separate pieces of property before the first Tuesday. In this situation, with a preliminary bid of $8 million, and I believe the evidence clearly shows in reality the property only had a market value of $6.5 to $6.9 million, but Provident bid $8 million for that property. It, after the foreclosure, of course, divided that $8 million bid price between the two tracts based on the only reasonable allocation it could do, and that was the market value of the two tracts. It overbid. It concedes that. But where we got lost in the lower court, and I believe where we got lost in the Court of Appeals, is a fixation with the concept that Provident is saying it's entitled and can use a market value to establish that deficiency. It has never attempted to do that. It has simply used the market value concept, which is not an obscene legal concept. In fact, the law, had this been an invalid foreclosure, Mr. Stevens would have been entitled to utilize the market value. We're not using the market value to establish deficiency. We're simply saying, here's an $8 million bid price, two separate pieces of property recited in the trustee deed. What is the best way to ensure the fair distribution of that $8 million without being accused or without attempting to rig it where we get more or less? The only way to do that is by market value analysis. And the testimony of the experts was that the income approach utilized both by Mr. Diltz and by Kelly Miller was the appropriate methodology. That was to be above board. Bidding $1,100,000 over the market price was above board. Provident doesn't come in under the guise of attempting to hoodwink Mr. Stevens on his guarantee limits. It simply wants what Mr. Stevens guaranteed it would have, and that is a limited return on its $11 million investment in that shopping center.
Is it a common practice for creditors to do this, to bid a lump sum on more than one property?
Depends upon the instrument, Your Honor, but as a practical matter, I would not say it would be common practice at all. It is common practice and was common practice in that time frame, and there's no evidence in the record of this, but it was common practice that you would go to the courthouse with a preliminary appraisal without a final appraisal price and typically bid possibly over the true value of the property so that the lender could get that property back and secure the rents and proceeds.
But putting a single bid on two separate tracks, was that a prevalent practice, or is that?
No, that was not a prevalent practice.
Why was it done here?
There's no evidence, and there was no testimony other than Eric Ramsey, the substitute trustee, testified that Provident wanted to foreclose as expeditiously as possible. The 4th of July, 1989 was that date, and at that time, Kelly Miller, the appraiser, only had a preliminary bid of $8 million, and as he testified in the second trial of this case, he did not attempt to divide that between the two separate tracks. But
two tracks were part of one shopping center?
Yes, Your Honor. Two tracks basically substantially together comprise a shopping center adjacent. But to allocate that process or that bid between the two pieces of property, that's what Mr. Dilks undertook to do. And as erroneously stated and I believe some of the opinions, the evaluation of Dilks and Miller were as of July 1st, 1989. They were not 4 months down the line. They were doing their evaluation and division based on the market value of that property on July 1st, 1989, just before the foreclosure. When the current case was first sent to the Dallas Court of Appeals, Dallas Court of Appeals flat out said, there is not a waiver on a single bid. Based on the evidence we have before us, and I submit to the court that the evidence in front of the Dallas Court of Appeals the first time was the same evidence that was in front of it the second time. And they held once that it was not a waiver of a single bid. They also held that, contrary to Stephen's argument that the Campagna case disallowed extrinsic evidence to vary a bid amount, it simply explained that what Provident was doing was not trying to change the bid price. They were simply allocating. They were not trying to put parole evidence on to vary the terms of the substitute trustee's deed. They were simply allocating that price between the two. Extrinsic evidence is always necessary to establish a deficiency because you have to have all the offsets. You have to have the attorney's fees. It is not just a simple process of taking the substitute trustee deed, subtracting it from the note price and doing the calculation. You're always going to have extrinsic evidence. The key here, again, as I say, was the court's misconception, in my opinion, that Provident was attempting to substitute a market value amount for the bid amount. The $8 million amount was clearly allocated, and I have before each of the justices Exhibit 14, which was discussed at both the trial and the appellate level. And it attempts to go through the two loans, show the bid amount allocated, and it was a straight percentage with credit given to the loan amount and the maximum allowed under the first loan being the 1.2 approximately, and the second deficiency being 1.4 plus interest plus attorney's fees. There was no controverting evidence that established or even brought into issue that Provident played with these numbers or that Provident miscalculated the market value or the market value was wrong or the income approach was not the correct methodology. There was no testimony that the market value that the market values utilized to allocate the bid price were rigged or improper in any way. It was uncontroverted. And I submit that 2 years ago the Dallas Court of Appeals would not have sent me back to the trial court saying there was no waiver if they intended and if they meant there to be a waiver on a single bid, because the single bid has been uncontroverted since Mr. Ramsey was videotaped on courthouse steps July 4th, 1989. If I have any questions, I'll reserve my time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Please, the court. Good afternoon. I disagree with Mr. Fredrickson's characterization of the issue in this case. I think the issue in this case is, does the Texas law in effect at the time of the sales allow Provident to attempt to establish its claim with evidence of deficiencies based on an artificial, subsequently determined allocation of the sales prices done after the sale. Now, the governing legal principle in this case was set down by this court in 1942 in Maupin versus Cheney, and the court restated it in 1965. And distilled to its essence, it is, if the foreclosure sale is valid, the amount to be credited for deficiency judgment purposes is the amount bid and received at the foreclosure sale, even if that price is established by the amount the lender bid.
Is there any case law that is able to find that requires allocation when you have to try to make up one shopping center like that?
No, sir. I have not been able to. I've looked at this as Mr. Fredrickson has.
Why should there be allocation?
Why shouldn't there
be? No, why should there be? And how will you harm?
Well, Your Honor, the harm in this case goes beyond Mr. Stevens. It goes to the fact that if you allow an allocation in this case post-foreclosure, you increase the risk to a guarantor, the principal obligor, that it can be rigged, as Mr. Fredrickson called it, that you can allocate the deficiency to create the maximum liability to a certain party or parties.
But in this case, he still owes $1 million no matter what.
In this case, the minimum liability would be $1,256,000, provided you comply with the deeds of trust.
So why, if you're right, shouldn't the judgment at least be reformed from zero to that amount?
Well,
I mean, if everything else you say is right.
There may not be a reason that it shouldn't be reformed other than the fact that that's not the evidence they put on. They put on evidence that it's the bid amount was $4,526,000 on one tract and $3,488,000 on the other. Mr. Korn, in his summary judgment affidavit before the when we went up to the Court of Appeals the first time, he didn't state there was an allocation. He stated that Provident bid and purchased Tract 1 for $3,488,000 and bid and purchased Tract 2 at the sale for $4,512,000. Provident has always treated these properties as if they were cross-collateralized. They are not. You have two notes, two separate deeds of trust, two limited guarantees. One limited guarantee is on the $5,525,000 note. That's for 25% of that loan amount.
Do you concede that the first decision of the Court of Appeals held that there was no waiver of the deficiency in submitting a single bid?
Basically, what the Court of Appeals held, Your Honor, the way I see it, is they held that we don't have enough evidence in front of us to decide one way or the other. We can't tell how Provident allocated it. We're going to allow you to put on evidence regarding what the deficiency price is, because the
what evidence should they have?
What they should have put on? That's very simple. What they should have put on was a separate bid price for each property. If they hadn't rushed into this and been so willing to and so anxious to foreclose on the 4th of July, 1989, they would have waited until they had an appraisal for both tracts of the property, or they would have made an allocation on their own and gone to the sale with that. Or the other thing you could have done was to wait until you've got an appraisal for tract one and tract two.
Assuming that the Court of Appeals decision is either correct or binding in this case, that an allocation can be made after the sale, what way do you say that the allocation should be made? How should it be made?
That's not what the Court of Appeals said. They didn't say an allocation could be made. What they said was is you can introduce extrinsic evidence as to the deficiency. That extrinsic evidence should be what your bid price is on Track 1 and what your bid price is on Track 2. Provident can't get there under the law as it exists because they didn't follow the law, quite simply.
What law is there that says you've got the bid separate?
There's no law that says you've got to bid separately, Your Honor, but the law that this court established says that if the foreclosure sale is valid, you take the amount of the sale price and subtract it from the note.
All right.
Real
estate. $11 million owed,
an 8 million bid, so that's 3 million. That's easy.
But in this case, you've got guarantees that are limited. You've got $1,256,000 on one.
Well, but there's a $3 million deficiency on these two notes. There's no question about that.
Yeah. Can't argue with that. But the problem you've got is they want to come back in after the fact and allocate.
So they could have allocated going in.
Yeah. If Eric Ramsey had gone to the foreclosure sale and said, I allocate $4 million to track one and $4 million to track two, we wouldn't be here on this.
And they could have done that on some arbitrary basis. They wouldn't have had to present evidence of why or how they did it. They could have just done it that way.
They could have done it that way, but the chances are we would have gotten into that question at the trial level as to whether or not it was arbitrary. In this case, Provident didn't do that.
Could you have done that here?
Could we have done that here?
Yes, sir.
It wasn't the issue, Your Honor. The issue was, what's the bid price? The bid price is quite clear. Mr. Ramsey stated it. I bid $8 million for both properties.
But could you, you didn't challenge the validity of the foreclosure. Could you not have, in this case, questioned either their fair market value they put on the two lots, the methodology they used in coming to the fair market value, the methodology that they used in the allocations, and whether or not your client will, the guarantee on your client was subject to being taken because of their method of allocation? Could you not have raised all these same sort of issues about the fairness of the allocation and that sort of thing that you could have done if you were attacking the foreclosure?
You could do anything, Your Honor, but the problem is none of it's relevant under the law as it exists. It says you take the bid price and you subtract it from the amount of the debt. I do need to clear up one thing that Mr. Fredrickson said, which is incorrect. Mr. Ramsey did not testify at the trial, and he did not offer any summary judgment evidence. The witnesses at the trial were Dilks, Miller, Korn, for Provident. Mr. Ramsey never testified in this case. And
if we determine that, I think basically everybody is, there's no law that prohibits the allocation. Your argument is simply that if you have, that you take the bid price and subtract that from the debt, and you're saying that the only reasonable reading of that is the bid price is as to a particular piece of property and must be subtracted against a particular note, apparently is your argument. And having failed to designate the foreclosure, they lose. If we don't go with you on that, if we say that you can bid all the property you want to, and the only issue that's left to be attacked is the allocation, the methodology, based on the record in this case, you would lose.
Not necessarily. I think you have the question then as to whether or not, which it didn't really come up at the trial or the appellate level, is whether or not they've complied with the deed of trust. What the deed of trust says. The deed of trust doesn't say anything about the fact that you can go out and sell this property with other tracts of property and do any kind of an allocation. The deed of trust states that if Provident happens to be the one who wants to buy this property at the sale, they have to credit the purchase price back against the indebtedness. They can take away their costs, they can add in their costs of sale, but that's what the deed of trust says that they have to do with respect to if they want to buy this property at foreclosure sale. They have to credit the purchase price. The purchase price is $8 million.
It is true, I take it, as the petitioner argues, that you don't argue for a different division of the price. You just argue that there can't be a deficiency in these circumstances. Is that true?
Your Honor, I argue that there has to be a different division on the price, because if you do it properly, you go in and you make a bid for each separate tract at the foreclosure sale. That's what good, sound real estate practice is you go in and make that bid at the foreclosure sale.
What do you argue the individual prices should be in this context?
I have no idea what they should have been. I know what they say their fair market value appraisal is. If we had to get into fair market value testimony, Your Honor, if that had been relevant in this case, we probably would have had our own appraiser. But it wasn't relevant in this case.
So my question is, you don't disagree with his statement that you don't argue for a different split of the purchase price?
I might argue for a different split, Your Honor, depending on what my appraiser tells me the fair market value of those tracts is.
You haven't done it so far, I take it.
No, there was no need to under the law.
What is the bottom line result? You just want us to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, which in effect has the result of getting your client off on his personal guarantee.
Yes, I want
in excess of $1 million.
I want the court to affirm the judgment. Provident rushed into this.
Which has the effect of excusing the client from paying something that he promised to pay.
It has the effect. Mr. Stevens will not have to pay. The Provident rushed into this. They filed their claim untimely in the Hunt bankruptcy. That's in the record. They had a claim against Herbert Hunt. They didn't file that timely. The bankruptcy judge said, you can't file this claim. They appealed that. They settled that claim later on with Mr. Hunt's liquidating trustee for $10 and other good and valuable consideration. They didn't credit that in this case. There's nothing you will find in Exhibit the Filk's calculations that were handed to you that says they credited that in any manner. Mr. Korn testified at the trial. He didn't know what was done with respect to the Hunt bankruptcy, but he knew that there was no credit allowed for that. That would be a credit that would have to be allowed in this case, because if they received something from Mr. Hunt's portion of that indebtedness, it reduces Mr. Stevens' liability. Nobody knows what that is. Your Honors, the rule in this case is basically limited to the law as it was in effect prior to 1991. The law was changed by Property Code Section 51.003, which tried, in some respects, to eliminate the potential for creditors underbidding at foreclosure sales by allowing, in the instance where a principal obligor or secondary obligor was sued for a deficiency, they could ask the court to determine the fair market value of the property. And some of the things you take into account under that statute are the appraisals. What is this property appraised for? What is its fair market value? This case is basically limited to its facts. It's not a situation that's going to reoccur unless the court wants to change the law and say that an allocation is permitted. And then I think the court is opening a Pandora's box as to whether or not you're going to have to consider allocation evidence in cases occurring after 1991. This sale occurred in 1989. To my knowledge, I have never even heard of another case that's come up like this. In that respect, it's a little unique. But the law is pretty clear, at least from what this court established back in 1942 and the way the courts of appeal have applied it and the way the federal courts have applied it. And I direct the court's attention to Saunders, which is cited in the brief. It's a bankruptcy court opinion out of the Western District. Judge Clark had a question come up in a chapter proceeding there about whether or not you could use, how you would value under Section 506 of the Bankruptcy Code, which is how do you value a secured creditor's claim. And in this particular instance, the property had already been foreclosed on. And he said, no, he said, this issue is moot. He said the foreclosure sale is the determining factor. It sets what the purchase price is, and that's how we determine what the value of the secured claim is, what the value of the unsecured claim is for any deficiency. That's the determining factor.
Well, we have a purchase price. You just don't know how it's allocated between the two tracts. Is that correct?
You have a purchase price of $8 million for both. $8 million for the other.
On an $11 million debt.
On an $11 million debt. Provident carries it. The Provident carries the property on at $12 million on their own financial statements. Now, how or where that comes from, I don't know. It's in there. There's no testimony in the record as to how that was done, what it dealt with, but that's how they carry it on their books. They have a $12 million piece of property. They have whatever they received out of the Hunt bankruptcy. And now they want $5 million for Mr. Stevens on their $11 million in notes. court doesn't have any more questions, I can turn in the rest of my time.
Anything further?
Thank you, counsel.
If I might, Your Honor, just make reference to five quick items. First of all, Ms. Whitmore commented about the testimony of Eric Ramsey. Eric Ramsey's video and transcript was admitted into evidence by Mr. Whitmore, and his bid, his statements, his every word and action on the courthouse step was admitted into evidence, and that's what I was referring to, it was a misunderstanding. But more importantly, more critical misunderstandings that Mr. Whitmore has. First of all, there is nothing artificial about an MAI prepared bid appraisal allocating a bid price. This was not some magical numbers that we came up with. We followed the correct methodology that had been scrutinized by the courts, and Steve has had an opportunity to question that and raise questions regarding the validity, and he would not touch that for the world, because in reality the property was only worth $6.5 to $6.9 million, and if he questioned the validity of the foreclosure sale, he would then, pursuant to the court's this court's ruling in Terrence Savings, would be cast upon the fair market value as the offset to the price.
If it's only worth $6 million, why are you carrying it to $12 million in your books?
Your Honor, I believe, and I dispute, that what was put into evidence was, I believe, the Insurance Commission, State of Texas Insurance Commission annual report, or asset report, and I believe what we find there is that the property was listed at the same value that they loaned the money on, the $11+ million they loaned back in 85. I don't think there's any question by 88 that property was worth 6.5, or 6 to 6.9.
How about the bankruptcy settlement that they have received no credit for?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
What about the bankruptcy settlement that they have not received any credit for?
Your Honor, I would cite the court once again to the Tarrant County, Tarrant Savings case, Lucky Homes. Principally, once petitioner's case has been made out, the burden shifts to respondents, defendants in the trial court, to show some reason for denying recovery. Once we put on Corn's testimony, not Dills, but Corn was the one who testified to Exhibit 14, and he established what he knew to be the offsets. The burden was Stevens to come in and show that he should have some credit from a bankruptcy. There was no testimony about a bankruptcy. There was a certified copy of a pleading that was put in to evidence showing some form of settlement between Hunt and Providence. And by the way, of course, there's an independent liability to Stevens under his unconditional guarantee, separate and apart from what we got from Hunt, if we got anything. I don't know what we got from Hunt, but the burden on that matter was on Mr. Stevens' counsel to testify. Was it $10? Was it, did they simply miss their filing date to seek their claim? If so, that's his burden. Second thing I want to point out, Justice Owen referenced the issue of waiver in the Court of Appeals. In the transcript at page 105, the first Court of Appeals decision, Justice Stewart at the time said, Stevens claimed that Provident waived its right to collect a deficiency when a single price for two properties, when it bid a single price for two properties, is also faulty. They knew back in 1992 that there was a single bid price. And they considered the argument that Stevens made that there was a waiver. And they said, no, there's no waiver. Providence single bid, absent any other evidence, is not enough to prove waiver. There was no other, there's no waiver in this case because there was no other evidence other than what we have, the same fact we've had since July 4th, 1989. We had a single bid. We know that. But there was nothing magical or mystical about how we allocated that. The offset and the concept that would allow this court to award Provident a return, be it the uncontested 1.25, or as we argue, its full entitlement, lies in the Tarrant County Lucky Homes case. Once we establish that the deeds exist, the notes exist, the guarantees exist, we're the owners of it, all of this was stipulated to, all of this is in the record, and once we establish and put on evidence of how we reasonably allocated that bid price to come up with the deficiency, and once Stevens elects to not put on that testimony and not contest that,
and not carry his burden as set out by the Supreme Court in Tarrant County Lefty Holmes, then we're entitled to a judgment for our full amount. There is no allegation of wrongdoing. There's no allegation of hanky-panky with this bid process. If there was, if they legitimately thought that was the case, evidence, allegations and evidence would have been put on in the lower court.
You're asking this court to render judgment for Provident?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in this call, and the court will take another recess.